First to a small reflection on maybe unintended consequences of completely admirable intentions. I'll let you be the judge after you've heard the thinking of a distinguished guest to Australia right now, Professor Philippe Sands, who's here for the Melbourne Writers' Festival. You might have heard him first, as did I, on Life Matters with Cathy McCullough the week before, about his new book East West Street on the origins of genocide and crimes against humanity, a work that's had rave reviews for its storytelling, its detective-like search for the details behind four key characters from early 20th century Ukraine, two of whom fundamentally changed our legal notions of terrible collective crimes against people, and some dilemmas too. It made gripping listening, and I don't intend to go over all the detail. It also includes much of Professor Sands' family, who were essentially wiped out in the Holocaust, and you can always go back and check the audio streaming on the Life Matters website. But at one point he mused out loud, if I heard him right, about whether the whole purpose behind these new legal entities which emerged after World War II, genocide and crimes against humanity, designed to protect vulnerable groups, whether they'd backfired, had made them more vulnerable. So we decided to invite him back while he's still with us in Australia, and I'm delighted to welcome him.
Terrific to be back, and how wonderful that you listened to it and you thought there was something worth coming back on.
Well, look, I did, because you've made your name by being a human rights lawyer, an academic, a novelist. Were you wondering about whether the legalities designed to protect have actually done the opposite?
I'd never really thought about it. I'd done cases starting in the mid-1990s out of Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Chile, dealing with these concepts, crimes against humanity and genocide. Crimes against humanity is about the protection of individuals. Genocide is about the protection of groups. And in the course of researching this book, which I started in 2010, I learned, I did not know this, that in 1945, when the two concepts were invented, there was a tremendous battle between the two men who invented the concepts. Hirsch Lauterpacht, a Cambridge academic, wanted to protect individuals, and he pushed for the concept of crimes against humanity. Lemkin said, no, what you need is something that protects groups, because people don't get killed because of their individual qualities, they get killed because they're a member of a group, and the law needs to reflect that. The upshot was that by 1946, both crimes against humanity and genocide were emerging as part of the international legal order. Nothing happened for 50 years. And then in 1993-94, we get Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and both concepts come into play. And what has emerged, and perhaps we can talk about this a bit more, is that somehow genocide has become the crime of crimes. And victims, if they don't get their crime in these mass killing cases labeled as a genocide, get to be deeply upset. In other words, crimes against humanity and even war crimes isn't enough. And that's what I've begun to think about.
Because if I heard you correctly, you said in its own way, it tends to single out groups, which is the very thing that one assumes these men wanted to avoid.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, so let's just take it step by step. Lauterpacht says the law must protect individuals. And Lauterpacht further believed that the concept of genocide was dangerous, because what it would do, his view was, states kill people. And if you create a new concept of genocide which focuses on groups rather than just states, you will replace the oppression and the tyranny of the state with the oppression and the tyranny of the groups. In other words, his concern was the concept of genocide will give rise to the very conditions that it is intended to prevent. It will reinforce the sense of them and us. It will reinforce the sentiment of one group against another group. And if you just take an example of that, I can explore it and explain it a bit more clearly. Ex-Yugoslavia. The killings at Srebrenica in Bosnia were called by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia a genocide, and that made front page news. The killings at Vukovar were not called a genocide, although the Croats wanted it to be called a genocide, and I was involved in one of those cases as the lawyer for Croatia. Instead, they just got the label crimes against humanity. And that has created, let's say, an unhappiness. Why did one community get it recognized as a genocide? The Bosnians, the other community, only got it recognized as a crime against humanity, a sort of division two in a sort of footballing type.
And why didn't you
parlance.
Go, if you were defending them, why didn't you go for genocide?
We went for genocide. in the case for Croatia against Serbia for what happened at Vukovar. And the International Court of Justice said we had not proved that the killings had taken place in such a way as to satisfy the definition of genocide. Namely, we had not proven that the killings were motivated by the intention to destroy a group. And so what you get is a situation in which one community, Croatians, are unhappy that another community, Bosnians in this case, have got the label, whereas others haven't. Now, if you imagine yourself, I'm inviting your listeners to imagine themselves, you're sitting in a room with a group of lawyers for a government, and the lawyers for the government, let's just say Government X, say to you, we want this to be shown to be a genocide. And you say to them, okay, well, we'll do our best, but what we have to prove for it to be genocide is to show that it amounted to a killing accompanied by or motivated by the intention to destroy a group. And if you say to a government or you say to a group of lawyers, I'm sorry, the evidence is not strong enough, what that tends to do, I've noticed in my practice, is reinforce the bitterness, the hatred, the opposition to the other group, the group of perpetrators. And so I must say I've reached a conclusion where I've started to ask the question, was it such a good idea to come up with the concept of genocide? I know. Where do
you start? Where does that leave you? I'll come. But you also looked at history in your studies for this book, and you cite the Minorities Treaty imposed after World War I as further example, I think, anyway, if I read you properly, of unintended consequences. Could you develop that, please?
Right. I mean, this all goes back to 1919, the famous Treaty of Versailles. Poland has emerged as a new entity, and it wants to be described and recognized as a state under international law. The Americans, the British basically say, look, we're happy for you to be a state, but in order to be a state, you've got to sign this little piece of paper called a Minorities Treaty, which guarantees the protection of the rights of minorities, as they were then called. Minorities refers in a different way to another set of groups. You've got to protect the Germans, you've got to protect the Jews, you've got to protect the Russians, whatever. And what that did was create a system in which certain groups were protected and could have access to international courts, but other groups could not. And that created a form of discrimination. Mm. What was thought about at that time, of course, was instead of having minority rights or rights for minority groups, you'd have something called individual rights for all. But of course, the British colonial power objected to that because they said, literally they said, if we have individual rights rather than rights for minority groups, then the Chinese of Liverpool will start complaining, the Irish, the Australians, the Indians will all say, oh, we've got rights also. And so this idea of the distinction between the individual and the group really dates back to that period.
And of course, British common law, am I right? I'm not a lawyer, but its magic, as it were, was its focus on the individual. That's the whole sort of nature of the build-up, you know, bit by bit of laws that are really critically important for the way we live these days.
In a certain sense, that's right. I mean, there's a real irony here. If you go back to 1919, the common law system, the English way, you know, every man's home is his castle, every woman's home is her castle, that individual people have basic rights that need to be protected. But when it came to the international domain, the British were really pretty opposed to the idea of individual rights at the international level. But then when it comes to Nuremberg, 30 years later, the position changes. The British and the Americans are strongly supportive of individual rights, that's to say, crimes against humanity. But the Americans, for example, never refer to the concept of genocide once in the Nuremberg trial. You will not find it coming out of the mouths of Robert Jackson or any other American prosecutor. Why? Because the Americans were worried that blacks or American Indians would take advantage of the concept of genocide and use it against the United States. And the British started with that position because of course, their history, including their history in Australia. And so you've got political incentives against going the genocide route. And the Americans, in fact, didn't become parties to the famous convention in 1948. Finally, a convention was adopted on the prevention and punishment of genocide. If you remember, the Americans did not sign it. They only became parties to it 40 years later in 1988. And the circumstances are quite ironic. You may remember President Reagan, as he then was, made a trip to Germany, and inadvertently he visited a cemetery and visited some graves of some SS officers. There was a huge political stink, And in the fallout from that political stink, Reagan said, OK, I'll ratify the Genocide Convention.
Goodness me. So, Philippe, where does this leave you then? So this is obviously a very big ongoing debate. Has it changed your practice or your decision-making?
Well, it hasn't changed my practice, but the cases go on, and we have a sort of cab rank principle in England, as in Australia, you take on the cases that come in, and the law is as it is. But what it's caused me to think is that you adopt a well-meaning law. Of course, you're familiar with this, and your listeners will be familiar with this at the domestic level in Queensland, where I am now, in Brisbane, or in Victoria, or even in England or in Scotland. You adopt a law, and you think you're dealing with an issue in a way that is helpful, but it has unintended consequences that no one had predicted. And I think the unintended consequence of having both genocide and crimes against humanity has been to diminish the value of crimes against humanity and war crimes. Look, put it very clearly. One case that's going on right now is the appalling treatment of Yazidi women in northern Iraq and Syria, that the terrible acts of rape perpetrated against thousands and thousands of women and young girls. Whilst that was called a crime against humanity, it didn't make it even into the papers. The moment the Obama administration called it a genocide, it went straight on to page one and everyone paid attention to it. So the word genocide has this magic associated with it. It's the atrocity of atrocities, the horror of horrors. And the unintended consequence of that is that it sort of normalizes and regularizes other concepts like crimes against humanity and war crimes. And I think that's a problem.
Okay, well, I will let listeners be the judge. My gosh, that is quite thorny.
I mean, the issue to think about, it's one, putting it down straight to the personal level, okay? It's asking you this question. Who are you? Are you an individual or are you a group? And if your essential well-being, your right to life is protected, do you want it protected because of your inherent qualities as an individual, or do you want to be protected because you happen to be a member of a particular group? And asking the question in that way forces us to ask, really, who are we? Of course, we're both individuals and members of a group, but the law operates in a complex way, and how it functions when someone gets caught up in these horrors, I think, has important practical consequences.
Philippe Sands, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Absolutely terrific to be with you.
And Philippe Sands' book, if that's provoked you to think, is East West Street on the Origins of Genocide and Crimes Against Humanity. It's a Weidenfeld and Nicholson publication distributed by Hachette in Australia. And you might like to seek it out and let us know where you come down on that particular set of questions he poses.
Discover the best of RN on Facebook. Simply search for ABC RN.